I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome to Bus Boys and Poets. We're here this evening with David Swanson, who has written the book War is a Lie. We are broadcasting for the Mark Steiner Show, the Center for Emerging Media, for Free Speech TV, down here at 5th and K at Bus Boys and Poets. David was on our show recently by phone, and we thought it more important to see each other face-to-face once again. He was on our election night coverage at Bus Boys and Poets, the other location. And we're here with a live audience, and we welcome all of you as well. And let you know, we have a roving mic in the audience, so you can participate in this conversation, because we want you involved in this. And David, good to see you. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks, Mark.
So before we begin with the book, I think a good place to start is what you did yesterday, what happened at Quantico, and why you're here now as opposed to in the clutches of the United States Marines.
Yes. Well, many of us went down to Quantico Marine Base yesterday, including many of you in the room here that I see, to protest the treatment of Bradley Manning, who, regardless of what you think of what he's accused of, has been kept in solitary confinement for 8 months without having been put on trial for anything. Which is cruel and unusual, and is admittedly unusual, and it can amount to torture, as well as clearly inhumane treatment. And so a lot of us actually believe the man is a hero. And yet this is part of the fundamental lies that are built into our understanding of war, this idea that someone who tells us about war crimes, when ordinarily to not point out a felony is itself a crime, that someone who does this is then himself a traitor. We went down and we protested and we blocked the road at the entrance to Quantico Marine Base, and I took a video camera and asked some of the Marines questions, which is apparently, you know, an offensive act of, you know, we're criminalizing journalism. This was journalism. And at one point, a couple of these Marines started to grab me and pull me towards the base, and to all appearances, I was going to be thrown somewhere in the brig, probably not going to have the luck to be next door to Bradley and be able to talk to him. But
I doubt it.
but about 20 of our great peace activists grabbed me and pulled me back, and another one of whom, Tige Berry, was himself then grabbed and hauled away, and 10 or 20 people grabbed him back, and so no one was imprisoned, no one was hurt, and I think it's an excellent lesson, and it absolutely bewilders people who have been trained in blind obedience to see people act in a way that's absolutely contrary to what they've just been ordered. I think, you know, we weren't hostile with these Marines and these guards. We were asking them whether they were proud of defending locking people up for 8 months without trial, and I think the questions disturbed them because they know it's wrong.
One of the things Kevin said to me, Kevin Zeese I'm talking about, before we came in tonight, who was there with you at Quantico, along with Margaret Flowers and others that I know, was that I said to him, he said, he could have, Bradley could have, given those documents to Iran, to any government on the planet, but he chose instead to give them to Wikipedia, committing the crime of journalism. WikiLeaks. Wikipedia, I'm going to get lost forever. WikiLeaks. What?
He's alleged to have.
Alleged. But so, and I think that was an important distinction people also don't make, the government doesn't make. And you're right, what they are doing to him at the moment is tantamount to torture. In isolation, tortured in many ways, same way they did to people in Iran, in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's also buried so deep that we never hear of it. Nobody covers the demonstrations. Nobody covers what's happening to him.
Yeah, he, you know, typically to witness felonies and not report them is a crime. He didn't do that. He also didn't try to make money off of this, which he could have made a fortune. Allegedly, what he's done, judging by his supposed comments in an online chat, was to try to make information public in what he thought of as a representative republic so that people would know what their government was doing. And it seems to have had quite an effect in places like Tunisia. And I think that if Americans were to read what has come out thus far, in addition to the video of collateral murder that he allegedly released, in which American troops shoot up a van with injured people in it, they would have a different reaction. It's when people are so ignorant of what has been put out there that they're willing to accept that someone who's just been named a traitor and they know nothing else about him is a traitor. I think most Americans, if they knew the facts, would sympathize with Bradley Manning. And I think that as Dan Ellsberg has become acceptable and respected, and as Dr. Martin Luther King has become so acceptable and respected, they now claim he would support the wars. I think that Bradley Manning will be a hero. I hope he just doesn't have to spend the intervening decades in a cell.
Well, as long as folks like you keep going there and we go keep going there and bringing it up, the attention will grow, and hopefully that'll make a huge difference. Let's come to your book, War is a Lie. And we said it before we started this, we're going to give you a chance here to kind of, with the audience, before we begin, questions, answers from me and from the audience, is to kind of lay out your thesis about war is a lie.
Well, one idea behind writing the book was that, you know, the smart, informed people who were coming to me and telling me how outrageous the war on Iraq was, because for the first time ever a president had lied about a war, were spreading very damaging ideas. That, in fact, the lies that got us into Iraq are exactly typical, are very much like the lies that get us into any war. And that if you look at enough of these wars, U.S. wars and other wars, you can't find one that justifies the continuation of our war policies. And in fact, as the very worst thing that humanity has ever come up with, modern warfare ought to be dismissed in all cases. That is, you know, we don't talk about a good slavery or a just rape, but we all fantasize that maybe next month there will be a real war that's necessary and good. And if we understand that there can't be, then we begin to dismantle what Eisenhower 50 years ago yesterday called the military-industrial complex. It's this idea that we might have a good war, even if this one isn't it, that keeps that in place, which is itself a big source of momentum in generating wars. And so in the book, I go after the various claims, the various types of lies and deceptions that keep wars around and keep war policy around, and the ideas that aggressive wars are defensive, and the idea that wars can be humanitarian, and the idea that some people or some dictators are so evil that you just have to have a war. And I suggest that wars are not inevitable and are not justifiable, and that rather than having our State Department and our Justice Department and the rest of our government working for the war machine and planning potential scenarios for war anywhere at any time, we ought to be putting some resources into planning for the possibility of peace and using at least part of our government to work for peace. And that, in fact, it won't. This is not just an argument now about living better lives, although we could live vastly better lives if we shifted those resources. It's an argument about survival. We cannot survive another 50 years of advancing the military-industrial complex, not economically, not financially, not environmentally, not in terms of blowback or proliferation, not in terms of the stripping away of civil liberties and our representation in our government. We just cannot survive it. We have to end it.
So I think it's hard to argue that every war, hard not to argue, as you are arguing, that every war that, as you lay out in the book, from when you write about the Spanish-American War, and you wrote about World War I, and you wrote about World War II and the Civil War, and how each one of those began with lies. And I think that the history is irrefutable, that that you, as you lay out, that those wars began with lies. Then there's the complexity people have to address that. I'll throw examples to talk about. Where do we want to start? Let's work our way backwards. We all knew Vietnam was lying. I'll work my way back to Vietnam. In World War II, which is probably, World War II and the Civil War are probably the most difficult wars for people to wrestle with your analysis of what war means. And we talked about this before. World War II. You lay out in the book how Sinnott and his book and others exposed the Freedom of Information Act that Franklin Delano Roosevelt knew about the attack coming on Pearl Harbor. He wanted the attack on Pearl Harbor, right?
He did.
So tell that story a bit, and then let me ask you a question about that.
Well, it's not that attacking Pearl Harbor is defensible. It's not that Japan was not an imperial nation aggressively waging war. It's not that that isn't a horrendous crime. It's that our nation was a growing empire as well and very much wanted war and had come to see Japan much as we later came to see misguided disciples in Manuel Noriega or Saddam Hussein, people who were not countries that were not going to wage war on our behalf anymore, but were going to wage war on their own behalf, that were stepping out of line, that needed to be dealt with. We had imposed modernity and warfare on Japan. We had tried to use Japan to our ends in the Pacific.
Right.
And when we, when our nation decided to go another route, we spent decades building up bases and airstrips around the Pacific and intentionally antagonizing Japan. And in the lead up to Pearl Harbor, taking steps, including economic sanctions and including waging war with China on Japan, sending planes and pilots to China, doing everything possible to have war with Japan, but have Japan make the first strike. And in fact, our government knew in great detail when and where that strike was coming and allowed it to happen and sacrificed those lives and that equipment in order to get into war. And historians who have researched this and written about it have in many cases justified it and said, well, Roosevelt had campaigned, lying as they always do, that he wouldn't take us into war. He couldn't very well take us into war without someone else attacking us first. So he had to have that happen so that he could get into war in Europe, where we had to get into war. You know, we had to be in the war in Europe. And so people justify the lies, which is such a perversion of the facts and of the idea of democracy and representative government. It's just inexcusable.
Now, same with World War II for a moment. And most any war I could think of in human history, leaders have manipulated populations to go to war. I mean, that's how it happens. Also manipulated other nations to come in and attack so you can go to war. It's not a new phenomenon in war. And I think it was a new revelation because the Freedom of Information Act allowed us to understand what happened before World War II, as you wrote about in your book. The other hand, as I was reading that chapter, I kept thinking, but wait a minute. If we hadn't, let's guarantee, we were brought in by a lie, but if we hadn't fought that war and fascism won in Europe, in Asia, the power would be given to fascists in our own country, the racists who were already powerful in the South. I mean, there's a strong argument to be made that while the war was a lie, that what we were facing was an onslaught of a fascistic capitalism worse than the one we faced even at home, unless you were black down South.
Now, when Franklin Roosevelt claimed to have a map of how the Nazis would slice up the Americas, it was a crude forgery of Karl Rove quality. When Roosevelt claimed the Nazis were sinking U.S. ships unprovoked, it was blatant lies. And the idea that fascism was about to take over the globe and we needed to act defensively is pretty untenable. When previous emperors took over Europe, when Napoleon took over Europe, we stayed home. And just as the Nazis did, he lost to the Russians. I mean, all the movies are made about the U.S. going up against the Germans. 80% of their army went and destroyed itself against the Russians. So, you know, give them a little credit as far as the warfare goes. But we did not have to get to that point. We almost had a fascist coup in this country in the 30s, right? We didn't have to have fascism win by taking over France and England in order to have fascism here. We spent the 30s and the 40s with Wall Street financing fascism in Germany, right? We didn't have to do that. We could have financed nonviolent resistance training. We didn't have to put our money into eugenics research in Nazi Germany. And our corporations didn't have to keep working with Nazi Germany through the war. I mean, the hypocrisy is a problem, but the overblown claims of the likelihood of permanent global fascist rule are way overblown. I think there is very little evidence for that. And certainly we didn't have to spend decades going back to how we ended World War I, making it as likely as possible and avoiding all possibility of negotiation and peace and nonviolent resistance and focusing on war as the only alternative. It never was the only alternative.
And you're moving into, well, folks, we'll open the mics in the audience in about 10 minutes, so get ready to ask your questions and participate in this conversation, please. We look at the Civil War. Mm. Civil War is another war that you write about intensely in this book. And most people would agree that the Civil War was not, as you wrote, about ending slavery, at least that wasn't on Abraham Lincoln's mind. But clearly it was on the South's mind to keep slavery in place. Almost every declaration of secession had in it, we'll maintain slavery. Slavery is our right. And if you were a slave, whether the South, the North was fighting about slavery, for you, the war was about ending slavery. And in the end, the war did become about that because of the economic and military happenstance of that war. So that's another war I think that Americans have difficulty not thinking about as a just war.
Well, you know, attaching evil descriptions to the other side or benevolent outcomes to your side in a war, during it or after the fact, doesn't mean that the war wasn't the worst way to accomplish those same ends, right? I mean, we talk about World War II after the fact as saving the Jews when that had nothing to do with it, neither as real motivation or propaganda.
Right.
And when the Civil War began, it was not about ending slavery. It was about preserving the Union. Right, and certainly it was about secession was about preserving slavery, but the North insisting that you cannot secede, that you must go to war, was not about ending slavery. And in fact, it was when Union was no longer a sufficient motivation for Union soldiers to go and kill and die that Abraham Lincoln needed something else. And it was when there was the possibility of European nations coming in on the side of the South that Abraham Lincoln needed something else. And so, of course, he freed the slaves only in those places where he could not free the slaves without winning the war, not in the border states.
Not in Maryland, anyway. I mean.
And so looking at global history, most places that ended slavery did it without a war. We did it with a war. Most places that have developed more democratic rule, including our neighbors to the north, done it without the revolution. You know, we think that because something good can be attached to a war, we've justified the war, when we could have accomplished the same ends and perhaps better without the war. Imagine the South had left, and we had split up the country, right? Maybe we would still have a country half the size. Maybe that would enable us to get some voices heard in Washington. Our country is too big. But the South would have been isolated. The fugitive slave law wouldn't have lasted a week. And slavery wouldn't have lasted 6 months. I mean, you're not going to justify a war by attaching a noble motive to it when you could have accomplished the same thing without the war.
If we look at history, talk about then the places where the things you talk about were accomplished without wars like that. Canada seceded from Britain without war. But when you talk about our human history and the state of war in our human history, which has been constant throughout our civilizations, whatever they're, from Hopi civilization to British civilization, wherever they were, war has been a constant. So where does that fit into the scenario and the analysis of living a world without war?
Well, I disagree fundamentally, and I say so in the book, and I hope I document it. Most human societies have not had war. We have not had warfare back through the ages of human development. For most of our development, we were the prey of animals. When something resembling warfare developed, it was bands hunting animals. It was when we had killed off most of the larger animals and we had unemployable warriors who didn't produce their own food that they started looking at each other as sources of respectable employment. But when we developed complex sedentary societies, some of them had warfare and some of them did not. And many did not, and continents did not, and Australia did not until the white folks came, and parts of our own Southwest did not until the white folks came. And there have been nations that have refused new weapons. There have been nations that have done away with war. There have been nations that have shut down and disbanded their entire militaries and said no more. And today, most nations in the world do not go to war, are very reluctant to go to war. If the wealthy states that we drag into our coalitions of the willing were hungry for war and just refraining because they couldn't win them or due to a Pax Americana, then they would be eager to join these coalitions to go attack some impoverished nation or halfway around the globe that has oil. You know, but they aren't. They aren't. They have to be dragged kicking and screaming. And the source of the worst wars in human history, Europe, is never, again, ever going to be the source of a war. The European Union has unified. It's as likely as Maryland starting a war with Virginia. It's not going to happen. And so, for almost all of war, it was men alone. Now women are part of war, right? Well, if women can get in, why can't men get out, right? If we can have the same exact sorts of incidents that we use to start wars and avoid wars as we did repeatedly through the Cold War, right? Remember Bush telling Blair, "Oh, let's fly some planes low, get U-2 planes shot with UN colors on, and then we'll start a war." Well, when U-2s got shot down by the Soviet Union, we very specifically did not start a war because we didn't want to destroy the planet. And it can be possible to choose not to destroy regions of the planet. And at this point, we're going to have to stop the war machine or we will destroy the planet without nuclear holocaust. So I think, there has been warfare, but nothing like the extent to which 1950s American anthropologists pretended that man the warrior was our history. Right, that Newt Gingrich's story about bringing the giraffe home for dinner is not human history. Right, we look at the walls of Jericho and say, "Oh, those were for war; they were for flooding." We look at Australopithecine bones and we say, "Look at those wounds; they are teeth marks from cats." We were prey. We impose war on other human societies that haven't known it, and in fact, nobody anywhere until the past 50, 60 years has known anything that resembled our current warfare more than it resembled wrestling matches. I mean, modern technological warfare is a completely new thing that is so horrific compared to anything past that you can't say, "Oh, the Greeks got along okay fighting and killing each other." They didn't do anything like what we do to places like Baghdad and Kabul. They just didn't.
One of the things people said, say in response to the book, I had a conversation about your book the other night in a group that I go to once a month.
Glad to hear it.
Oh, yeah. It was part of the conversation we had. And some of the conversation revolved around Well, okay, it's true that there have been a lot of societies on the planet Earth until now who may have had warrior societies, like the Hopi, but who were ostensibly peaceful societies.
Well, so are we, no?
But no. No, because the difference is, as Martin Luther King talked about, was we are more concerned with war preparedness than societal preparedness to take care of our people, of our world, of our environment, of our children. And the question came up, well, where is the balance? Because we'll never get rid of, for want of a better term, the evil that lurks where it lurks. Anywhere in the... Because we'll never have a unified planet. So how do we respond to that as societies? How do we respond to the threats that come to us?
Well, the previous question went to the fact that this is not in our genes. It's not inevitable.
It's not in our
genes.
And
it's not even in the minds of us as Americans. If you survey Americans,
right,
a majority will say, take the money out of that military machine and put it into useful things. Right? It is in our government. It is built into systems of corruption of our government. And it is going to be very, very hard to stop. But that doesn't mean it can't be done. And it doesn't mean we can't have a unified planet. To have a unified planet, part of the planet will have to stop exploiting the rest of the planet, which is a great difference in the states that wage war from the comparison of France and Germany or Maryland and Virginia. We are exploiting other countries, but that will have to stop for environmental reasons as well. And you know, we are going to destroy ourselves in one way or another unless we radically change. And there is no reason we can't. Empires are going to go down one way or another. And we are smart enough, I think, to take this one down the easy way and to recognize that others, including Britain, have been better off when they lost their empire and to hurry up and lose it nonviolently.
So as we open this up, and folks, please, when you want to speak, raise your hand, and Kevin Zeese will pay attention to the audience and find you and have you join in this conversation. So what do you think, then, America does, Americans do? Your voice, whether people agree completely with what David Swanson says or not, or they didn't agree with what the Berrigan said completely or not, who I think are some of the angels of the planet in my book. Those voices aren't heard. The other voice is heard all the time. So somehow, the debate for the conscience of America has to be able to get its voice out to change the discussion, to alter the discussion.
Well, we haven't completely lost
a
voice.
No, we have not. I'm not saying that.
Right. But we haven't lost our voice, I think, to the extent that we tend to imagine. Right. I mean, when George W. Bush says in his book that in 2006, Mitch McConnell came privately and said, get the troops out of Iraq
right.
before the election.
Right.
And we were running around telling each other that all was hopeless and why should we have another march? Because we had a march last year and it didn't end the war. You know, the fact that our voice was, you know, an inch away from winning is important to know. And certainly
yeah.
we need a decent democratic small d communication system. We need to support shows like yours, media outlets like Free Speech TV, and all of the thousands of good ones that are growing, and stop using and stop buying ads in and stop giving any respectability to the corporate media outlets that are driving the war machine and destroying this world. And I think when we come to that understanding and we invest in communication to the extent that we need to the extent that everybody outside of the North American liberal has done already, we will have our voices heard. But we have majority opinion despite the communication system. We're down to 34% of Americans supporting the war in Afghanistan.
Right.
We just need the understanding to be deeper, to understand that this wasn't a war that we messed up somehow. It should have been run better. That war is the most serious crime and always will be every war, so that we can stop the machinery that is already ginning up the next ones.
Kevin, you have folks in the audience who want to speak with us?
Hi, my name is Mike. I have a question. I'd like to know, what is your perspective on dealing with Al-Qaeda and the Afghan war in general?
Well, I think that as propaganda tools go, Al-Qaeda is the most perfect creation ever. I think that, you know, the Soviet threat that you could find behind every shadow had the serious flaw that it could cease to exist, whereas Al-Qaeda can't. You know, the terrorist threat can't. You can never prove there's not a handful of terrorists out there trying to attack us. And certainly there are, and certainly they are growing as a result of our actions. And we have built Al-Qaeda in places like Iraq and Afghanistan through what we've done, rather than addressing crimes as crimes. So both before and after 9/11, the Taliban was willing to hand bin Laden over to a third country to be put on trial. And our president had no interest in that whatsoever. He didn't want to prosecute crimes and discourage crimes, and much less shift our behavior to stop provoking them. He wanted an excuse for war. And he wanted to use that excuse for war to start another war in Iraq, which made absolutely no sense in terms of law enforcement or in terms of deterrent or prevention of terrorism. We have had global terrorism predictably, and many of us predicted it, increase each and every year of the global war on terrorism. So you need a different approach, and people who commit mass murder need to be put on trial as mass murderers.
But, Mr. Swanson, one more question.
Go ahead. Don't hold us so close.
Prior to us invading Afghanistan, approximately 2 weeks before, 7 days prior actually, President Bush issued a statement where he gave Mullah Omar an ultimatum to turn bin Laden over, and he refused to do so. And I agree with some of your points that you're making right now as far as peace and war criminals and things of that nature, but I clearly recall on several different occasions the UN, as well as President Bush, directing the Taliban to turn Osama bin Laden over. And they basically told us to go to hell.
Well, no, they didn't. At first, they said, we want to see some evidence, some prima facie evidence of guilt. We want assurance that the death penalty will not be used. And we want to turn him over to a third neutral country. But as the bombing loomed, they dropped some of those conditions and said, we will turn him over to a third country, period. And George W. Bush said, not interested, we're going to war. But let's assume that what you said is what happened. There is still absolutely no moral, rational, or legal justification for having gone to war. You do not bomb a population of a nation because some rulers of that nation have refused to turn a prisoner over to be put on trial. That is the committing the most serious crime there is on the excuse that a much lesser crime has been committed, right? There was a survey done a couple of months ago in which over 90% of Afghans in the southern provinces could tell you what 9/11 was. They haven't heard about it. They don't know what it is. And yet, we're dropping missiles through their roofs. We're kicking in their doors. We're shooting them at checkpoints because somebody did something and we have to get back at them, right? Revenge has never been a legal justification for war. I certainly hope never will be. And is a rather primitive emotion. That's all it is. And so when a nation needs to turn someone over, as we need to turn 27 agents of the CIA over to Italy, where they've been convicted of kidnapping to torture, it doesn't justify Italy bombing Washington. It justifies Italy using what diplomatic nonviolent tools they can to pressure Washington. And they aren't attempting that at all, but they could.
Just to follow up on what he was saying, and then we'll go to the very next person in the audience. I was really fascinated by that part of your book, and I recalled it because we covered on our program the impending wars from 2001 on. And Andy Shalal was actually a guest on a couple of shows back in those days. And I was rereading a lot of the articles around Europe just to get the underpinnings of what you wrote in your book this morning. And some people argue that part of it was also part of a grave diplomatic game being played between the Taliban and the United States. It's not, just not all on the U.S. side in terms of playing shenanigans around bin Laden, but that the U.S. also wanted to go to war and didn't were incapable of reading the signs of what the Pashtun were saying. As Pashtun have said to me, they didn't understand, I think the word is abra, which means to the Pashtun that you have to give me some room. I'm giving you this story. You have to understand what I'm telling you so you can go around here and do what you have to do. I'm saying Osama is not here. He's hiding, which means I don't know where he is. You get him if you want him. There were a lot of games were being played back then, but clearly we didn't. But even if we had played that game, to get bin Laden would have taken some force.
But understand that it's the wrong question if the question is should we have a war or not, right? Just as does Iraq have weapons of mass destruction or not was the wrong frame for should we go to war or not. You right. can't go to war because somebody has some weapons, right? But that became the question. So should we go to war if the Taliban is cooperating with us on bin Laden or not is the wrong question. It doesn't justify going to war. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the ignorance is the main characteristic of everything we've been doing. We've learned in the past year, we've been holding meetings with a leader of the Taliban who's not member of the Taliban.
Right. Made a lot of money at it, but it wasn't right. I mean, so, but bin Laden did, Al-Qaeda did attack the United States of America. He did attack. They did attack America. So America has to have... Well, we can argue that, too. But I would argue that, but...
As with Bradley Manning, we say alleged until we at least put them on trial. We apparently have no interest in putting them on trial, so we're going to have to say alleged forever.
Well, I think their statements have been pretty clear that they've taped and said back what they've done. And I don't think there's, in my mind, there's not much doubt
I don't
about
think
it,
there's much question either.
But so the question is, how does a country address that? Clearly, attacking Afghanistan, killing thousands of Afghan people, creating a whole Pashtun resistance in two worlds is not the way to resolve that issue.
No.
So how do you resolve it?
Well, when the World Trade Center was bombed the first time, we put people on trial, convicted them, put them in prison. When our own homegrown terrorists attack Oklahoma City, you know, we don't bomb Oklahoma and then go bomb Oregon for good measure. We put them on trial. We treat
Iowa,
a crime
maybe.
As a crime. So whether it's a fair analogy or not, when you have a crime, you should treat it as a crime, not as an excuse for a war. Bear in mind that before we went into Afghanistan, George W. Bush had already said, hey, I have a microphone. George W. Bush had already said to Tony Blair, okay, we'll go into Afghanistan, but then we're going into Iraq, right? Within hours of 9/11 crimes, we were talking about our president and his underlings were talking about a war on Iraq, whether or not Iraq had any connection to it or not, right? So this was an opportunity for war. That was what it was viewed as. That was what it was used as.
We have somebody else, Kevin, out there, wants to ask a question.
Yes, okay. First, David, I want to caution you. You said it now that women are in the military, the men can leave. My point is, my suggestion is, now that gays are in the military, does that mean only all the heterosexuals can leave and only gays fight the wars? Is that what you're... Anyway, my question is, I agree with you all through the book, and I've got lots of things marked, as you saw, and the coalitions you mentioned in the last chapter on peace, environmental jobs, social security, schools, infrastructure, transportation, parks, housing, that's all great. They're domestic programs, but they're necessary but not sufficient, I think. I think we have to peel off some of the military, people who support the military, as well as some of the Tea Party folks. Some of them would agree to spend less money. We've got to convince them to spend less money on the military. The military perhaps can be used for the kind of peace project, but I'm not sure how to get there. That is, we want a peace or diplomacy alternative, which is often thought of as weak, a weak position for the U.S. So I think we have to convince people that the dialogue and the alternatives to war are okay, but we still have to fight the war machine. We have to siphon off some of those people, maybe into domestic work, steel, you know, transportation and such. That's where I think the problem is now. How do we get there?
Well, I agree. I think we have two problems, right? The first problem is the lack of sufficient understanding among a significant percentage of Americans of the problem of war. And so obviously I'm writing books and talking about it and doing what I can, and I'm very gratified that professors and teachers are using this book now, and I'm hoping that it's helpful. But we do have and have long had a majority of Americans who have wanted to start defunding the military machine and put that money into useful things that create jobs and save the environment and educate people. And we don't have representative government here in Washington. And so as I wrote about in my previous book, Daybreak, we need dramatic reforms of our government. We ought not to have to get to 95% before we get anywhere in Washington. You know, 60 or 70, 80% opposing a war or opposing military spending ought to be enough, right? And so we need to address those problems as well, the problems of financial corruption, of party corruption, of media corruption, and of all of the limitations that our system of government puts on representation. We have to work both these angles.
How do you, this is fine with that, how do you talk to an American population about the need for a military or no need for a military? Are we saying we have no need for a military in the United States? Or any country has no need for a military?
Well, there are countries that have no military. There are countries that are currently shutting down their militaries. But there are countries like Costa Rica that have no military, but they have our military now. But we have a military larger than the next 15 nations combined.
Right?
We could get rid of the majority of our military and still have the largest military in the world, still be able to destroy the entire planet many times over, right? We talk about defense, but if two nations, if just two nations attempted anything like what we do in the name of defense, we would have all-out global war, right? We have bases around the globe.
177 countries.
177 countries and growing, and we have sliced up the world into Central Command and Northern Command and Southern Command, and dominate it.
Right.
We dominate it. So you can go back 70 years or some other period and find a war you liked, but you can't use it as a justification for defensive wars by the United States today.
But the question I have, one thing you just commented on what you just said, to probe it a bit more, then we're back to the audience. I mean, I think anybody who's been to war or experienced a war or lived through a war would never want to do it again. Though that's not true. There's some guys I know who would go back in a heartbeat, but most people would not go back to a war if they've been through it. Because you live with it forever. It never leaves. But having said that, I think Americans would have people would have a hard time in general saying that a country has to have a right to defend itself, has to be prepared. Your army can do many other things. The Army of the United States of America used to build bridges, build dams, build highways, take care of floods, take care of people who are in distress. When they weren't destroying whole populations of Native Americans, they were doing other things. So there's always been a military in this country, and in almost every society that exists. So the question to me is a question of balance, of how you balance a society. The society just needs to take care of itself and defend itself if it needs to defend itself.
All right, but here's the thing. They don't hate us for our freedoms. They hate us for our bases and our bombs and our night raids. And
right.
If we're afraid of terrorist attacks, we ought to cease doing everything we can to provoke terrorist attacks.
Right.
Right? We did take the troops out of Saudi Arabia, but we put them in someplace else. And if we're thinking that a nation state is going to attack the United States, you know, we're crazy. I mean, it is just not happening. And so if you want to defend the United States, should a foreign nation actually attack it, then fine, build weapons that would be useful for that purpose. Nuclear bombs are not it. Chemical and biological weapons don't do it. You know, most of the weapons that we build and the fleets of aircraft carriers have nothing to do with defending the U.S. territory. They have to do with defending the imperial outposts at best, and imposing our will on the other nations of the world, for the most part. And so, you know, defensive war that's actually defensive, that's fighting off an attack, as opposed to, you know, we have to go attack an impoverished nation on the other side of the globe in defense, it has long been considered an exception to the crime of war, right? But it's been stretched to such an extent that nobody remembers that war is supposed to be a crime with small exceptions. So that today we learned that the Attorney General of England, is saying that he told Tony Blair that without UN authorization, going and attacking Iraq would be illegal, and Tony Blair went and told Parliament going and attacking Iraq would be legal. Now, who told Parliament to consist of a bunch of imbeciles, right? I mean, how can you believe that a war can be legal, right? We banned war in 1928. We banned war in 1945. War is the biggest crime with very limited exceptions. And so I side with Ambassador Kellogg, who in 1928 argued to the French foreign minister that we need to simply ban all wars without any exceptions, because the exceptions, whether defense wars or UN authorization, which didn't exist yet then, get stretched to the point where everybody forgets that war is illegal. And you don't have to tell anybody to defend themselves if they are actually attacked. They will do so violently or otherwise. And in fact, otherwise is often the more effective route at defending yourself.
All right, David.
Next question.
Yeah. So I would just encourage everybody to buy David's book, even if you don't, even if you disagree, at least listen to it, because it packs a heavy punch. My name's Jake. I'm an Afghanistan and Iraq vet, and David and some of you folks in here are friends. My question is, if you look at the world today, there is a movement within the world of civil unrest. For instance, I was in Lebanon this last summer, working with Iraqi refugees that are sitting inside of Lebanon, and there's all sorts of anti-Israeli movements, there's anti-American movements, there's intra-Lebanese movements, and this is taking place in Sri Lanka, Turkey, Yemen, all sorts of places. I mean, there's what David Kilcullen calls an inter-global insurgency amongst failed and corruption inside its failed states. Now, David, I'm curious, whether war is a lie or not, I mean, you can have the debate, but I'm curious, are you interested in the United States not being involved in this intra-global level of violence at all? I mean, should we just become isolationists? Or is there a way to get involved that would somewhat involve the military, or not at all? I mean, what would you say to the folks in this room and abroad about what it means of looking at this reality that there is global violence that's occurring?
Well, you know, after 9/11, there were various proposals for what to do. Shirin Ebadi, a Nobel Peace Prize winner from Iran, said that the United States ought to build an elementary school in Afghanistan, each one named for a victim of 9/11. That would not have been isolationism. It would have just been a very different form of involvement with other people, very, very different from dropping bombs and kicking in doors. I think when you look at what's come out through WikiLeaks, and I hope that the rest continues to come out, I don't see anything more valuable happening, including in its impact in places like Tunisia. I think what you see the U.S. doing is backing thugs, backing dictators, backing military coups in places like Honduras, taking advice on illegal wars from royalty and dictators, functioning in terms of its diplomatic corps primarily as assistant weapons salesmen and women for U.S. weapons companies. We are arming nations who are fighting each other with both sides supplied by U.S. weapons makers. We are potentially arming Saudi Arabia in a way never before seen so that they can hold off the threat of Iran's U.S.-made weapons. We are not a helpful influence on the world. And the alternative is not to bury your head in the sand. The alternative is to start relating to the world without the hostility, the distrust, the manipulation, the illegal spying, and the idea that other countries function primarily to buy our weapons. I think we should work with the world as partners. We should work with the world as friends. We should develop relationships that involve shared resources and nonviolent opportunities for shared connections. I don't think most Americans want isolation. It's just that we've come to this very exceptionalist view where it's our right to impose things on the rest of the world for their own good, whether they like it or not, including occupations, which we would never stand for ourselves.
Now, what you just said back there, and we'll go to the next question right here. There's one down here in front. One back there, then we'll come down front. Just pushing a bit what he was saying, though, that, and I remember the example of building every schools in Afghanistan as a way to respond, that, A, the Taliban would never put up with that. They wouldn't let the United States or anybody else who believed anything close to gender equality to build anything in Afghanistan like schools for young girls and boys, separate or together. It wouldn't have happened under the Taliban. I think the question was, and I think you're absolutely right, that we are a country so dominated by corporate power, by corporate America, so dominated by the power of wealth, and a lot of that wealth comes from the manufacture of weapons and guns, the same way we fuel. There would be no war in Mexico over narcotics if they weren't with our guns that we sell, our companies sell to the Mexican gangsters. All that's true. That has to change and change. It has to change. But I think his question was, what should be our role in the world? How do we live in a world that is a dangerous world with a lot of bad actors? Right now, we are one of those bad actors. Our country is. Our government is. But with a lot of bad actors. And how do we respond to that? How do you respond to what we face out there? That's what I think he was asking.
Well, first of all, just briefly, there are schools being built in Afghanistan that the Taliban is accepting because the local population wants them.
They were forced into it by, unfortunately, the war and some other circumstances. But at that point in 2001, the Taliban would never have built those schools.
Well, and now they will burn them if they are seen as an arm of a military occupation. But if, when in cases where they are seen as local projects supported by the people, they will not burn them. And it's this idea that we will drop in from the sky and impose things rather than offering aid to people who want it in ways that they want it under their local sovereignty, that we have to make that sort of shift. I mean, why is it that most of the human rights treaties that are signed and adhered to various degrees by most of the nations of the world are not signed or ratified or supported by our country? The International Criminal Court should be signed onto and supported. Mm-hmm. The United Nations should be given full support and should be democratized. It ought not to be our plaything. We ought to choose to work with the world as one among equals. And it would be a very different thing for Americans, but it would have, among other effects, ceasing to provoke such incredible hostility. We don't have to pull out of the world. The idea that 5% of the world can pull out from the other 95%, comes out of our idea of exceptionalism. We are part of the world, like it or not, yeah. But we are playing as a rogue criminal state, and we ought to be a member an internationally cooperative global citizen.
Amen to that. Okay. We have a question back here and one up here. Let's go to the question back there first, and we'll see how much more time we have.
Of Bradley Manning, who's been in solitary confinement now to the point where he may have permanent brain damage. Do you see as a good sign that the government is so upset about WikiLeaks? Do you think we're, like you mentioned the previous time when we were just that close to maybe changing government policy, do you think their fearfulness of WikiLeaks and Bradley Manning and other people like that shows that the government knows how close they are to being pushed by public opinion to change their direction?
Yes, I think you're absolutely right that they are terrified of information. When you have Congressman Peter King saying that what WikiLeaks has done, that is give newspapers some information on what the U.S. government is doing, is worse than being bombed, it illustrates that their irrationality, what they are afraid of and what they're not. You know, they would rather have our cities be bombed than have us know what our government is doing, right? And so putting out information about what our government is doing is an incredible threat to them. And now potentially putting out information about what very wealthy individuals are doing, their crimes and their evasions, is very, very threatening to these people. They do not want us to know. They know that knowledge is power. And yet you have a disturbing number of Americans who believe that ignorance is strength. That we should punish the people who are trying to tell us what our government is doing, rather than going and reading the information and realizing that we have had dozens and dozens of the most extreme crimes and abuses exposed and confirmed. Wars in places like Pakistan and Yemen and the lies about them from multiple countries. The pressure put on European nations to not investigate and prosecute our crimes and so forth. Americans ought to know these things. We cannot have a representative government without knowing these things, but they don't want us to have a representative government. They are afraid of the very same things that the elites in this country and others have been afraid of for centuries. Majority rule, democracy. They're terrified of it.
What is that?
David, I just have to say that I just don't know if there's anybody out there in the country that has the same combination of wit and intelligence that you have. And I so enjoy any opportunity to listen to you speak. So thank you very much and for writing this book.
Thank you, Bill.
You know, a lot of people in the room I know from collaborations and such, but I'm not going to take this opportunity to pitch an event that we're working on at the end of the week.
But
I want people to know that there is a rally, and I'll make an announcement later. I want to ask you a really serious question as a friend and as an ally. I want to know what a peace movement that's not wasting limited calories of people looks like. And you just said, you know, we need information so we can have a representative government. But earlier you said we don't actually have a representative government, because we actually have a corporatocracy currently. And it seems to me that if we're actually going to influence policy, that showing up for each anniversary of the occupation of another country, is not a way to build the movement. And I seriously am thinking that pissing in the wind for world peace is not necessarily doing it for me. And unless I'm engaged in a movement-building activity that actually is delivering some victories and delivering potential, and it has a realistic perspective, the strength we have and the strength we need, the power we have, the power we need, the differential, and how we move from the power we have to the power we need, I think we could be wasting our energy.
Well, if you won't do it, I will. From the 20th to the 22nd of this month, in this town, there will be events marking an anniversary, whether that's a futile waste of calories or not, of a Supreme Court ruling a year ago that gave corporations unlimited right to, including weapons-making corporations, to buy our elections. And you can certainly find links to that at warisacrime.org and elsewhere. But I think that the reforms that we need, including getting the money out of the system, are going to get us a representative government, but that we are not completely without it now, that enough of us doing the right things, pressuring in the right ways now can be heard. There just often are not enough of us. And I think that when we look back at the people who got us some of these rights that are being stripped away, who got us the right to vote, who got women the right to vote, who got civil rights for minority groups in this country, who got us the right to labor standards, many of them worked happily for a lifetime and died, and another generation won that victory. And they didn't say from week to week, you know, we had a march and we didn't get world peace yet, I don't think we should have any more marches. They said, we are bearing witness, we are doing what our conscience demands, and we are not doing it masochistically, but we are enjoying it because it is so much more enjoyable than sitting home and bitching. So it's not a question of hope. It's not a question of we're optimistic or we're pessimistic. It's a question of optimism of the will, as Gramsci called it, of determination to do what needs to be done and to enjoy it and to bring more people into it, whether we win or not. Absolutely, whether we... Correct.
Hi, David.
Hi.
Tad Daly. Thank you so much for a terrific presentation and what I am quite sure will be a terrific book. I would like to know if you would like to say something about what I think might be the worst lie of war ever. And that, I would submit, might be the atomic lies of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We were told in August of 1945 that the American government had only two choices. One, to drop atom bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, or two, to launch a huge conventional land invasion that would have killed, they always said, a million American troops and even more Japanese civilians, more than would have been killed at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And that, as I'm sure you know, was a big lie, because the American government knew that by the early summer of 1945, the Japanese were saying, you're demanding an unconditional surrender, America. All we ask is one conditional surrender. Just promise us that you won't remove this 2,000-year-old monarchy and put our emperor on trial and hang him by the neck as a war criminal. That's all we ask. And we said, no, that's not good enough. We have only these two choices. We chose Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And then the great irony is we let them keep the emperor anyway. And David, I think this might be the worst lie of war ever, because it led directly to the nuclear arms race. It someday may lead to a nuclear war itself. And that clearly will be the worst thing that ever happened to the human race, and arguably, therefore, the worst lie of war ever. And I invite your comments.
Well, it is in the book, and I do agree with you there. And Truman and our government did know that it was unnecessary, and the motivations did include the desire to test new weapons, which above all explains the second bombing of another city with a different type of weapon, and the desire to end the war with a statement to the Russians more than with a particular conclusion for the Japanese. It was an outrageous lie for the president to go on the air and say that he had just dropped this impressive, powerful weapon on a military base, when he had dropped it on a city. And I think if I were to debate your point, since it's never my inclination to agree with anyone, I would say that the idea that developed beginning with the Japanese bombings in China and with our Allied bombings in Europe and the Nazis' bombings in Europe, the idea that war could be expanded, justifiably be expanded to include the mass slaughter of civilians, that total war was a logical extension of war on a battlefield between two teams. I think that that led to the idea of dropping those bombs on cities. And most of the Japanese cities were not targets because there was nothing left of them at that point to bomb. They had been firebombed into nothing. And so I think this idea that the battlefield is now everybody's house and store and local shopping market, it would be my nominee for the biggest lie.
It's a huge lie. But the war is in the past, before the modern era, did the same things. I mean, this is nothing new. This is something that didn't occur just in the 20th century, 19th century. It occurred in the 13th century in China. It occurred during the Crusades, where entire cities were laid waste, where the Crusades walked into Jerusalem and killed every Muslim and Jew, and they said the streets ran with blood. This is not something that is just an occurrence of the modern era. War has always turned its wrath on the civilians of every nation that has been attacked.
Yes, it's an excellent point, but war also used to consist in a very large part of something else, namely battles on battlefields. Right? I mean, the battles of Fallujah happened in the city of Fallujah. The battles of Manassas, Virginia, happened in a big grassy area. Right? And certainly cities were attacked in the Civil War and whole cities were burned in the Civil War. But you also had battles on battlefields and you had soldiers fighting soldiers and you could tell who the enemy was. Now, when we have a war in a city, our soldiers are unable to distinguish the enemy from the supposed beneficiaries of their humanitarian actions, right? They can't tell the difference between them. The only people who stand out for who they are by appearance are our soldiers. And so there is a definite difference. And, you know, taking over a city in a medieval crusade is very different from bombing a nation with modern technology and technology that now allows bombing homes and sections of cities without even involving soldiers, with unmanned aircraft, and without a declaration of war, without any right, formalities right. whatsoever. This is all new.
We'll go back to the audience. I'm going to get stuck on this, but I think that my sense of history of world and wars that have been fought in this world, that the annihilation of populations and civilians is nothing new. That's happened in every war I've ever read about or studied. Again, whether you talk about the Chinese Wars of the 3rd century, the 13th century, or the Crusades, what we did here in America in the 19th century when we destroyed entire peoples throughout the West in our Indian Wars. I mean, we have been doing this as humankind forever. We just have a technology now to let us do it from a distance, to let us do in some more immediate, massive ways. Rather than taking 2 weeks to kill 25,000 people, we can kill them in 2 seconds.
Yes.
I mean, so that's the difference, but that has always existed in terms of war. It's not just us who's doing
this. But we no longer have trenches. We no longer have battlefields. We no longer have a big component of what everybody thinks of when they hear the word war. They think of soldiers fighting soldiers. They think of the Civil War in a particular way. They think of World War I France. This is what they have in their minds right. when you say war. And the fact that that doesn't exist anymore, that it's all slaughter of civilians now, is a change.
Well, I think we have time for one more question, right here, up front. Wait for the mic. Wait for the mic.
He's actually in a really early.
Right, but here's what we have to do. How much time do we have? How long have we been on?
15 minutes.
All right, we have just 10 more minutes or so that we can
I'll
stretch this.
I'll make it
this.
Quick.
So
I
one,
very
two,
much
and we just have to stop.
Support David's work and
no, we only
book.
Have we don't have that much time.
And he was kind enough to offer to counter recruitment groups, which I'm part of here in D.C., Choices, which goes into the D.C. high schools and talks to young people. Extra copies of the book so that we could distribute them into the high school libraries here. And if anybody's interested in our work, I have some of the materials over here on the table. I think the lies of war are profound, and while I agree with what you're saying about the civilian deaths in the past, they were never at the level that they are in modern war. In World War I, the civilian death percentage was 4%. In World War II, 25%. In Korea, 56%. And from Vietnam forward, 98% of the deaths in modern war are civilian deaths. That means modern war is genocide. It's also ethnocide, and it's also ecocide. And modern war can't go on. The lie about Afghanistan is deeper even than what's been discussed. The preparations to go into Afghanistan dated to 1999, and the war was staged for that October, well before 9/11. 9/11 is a convenient excuse. And wars are lies when they're over as well. Well, I'm just saying, I just don't have very much time left. I want to say that fascism did not lose World War II. Fascism continued and came here to the United States and guides our policy to this day. My question, if you want one, is I'd like to see what you think about the idea that to say that we have to have a military means that we have to have this military, or whether the military itself is part of the problem and how it's structured.
Well, I appreciate all of those comments, which are very well said, which your comments always are, John. And I, as you know, agree with you on many ways in which the military could be different. Typically, a volunteer organization is one that you can quit. This military is not that. This military is much too large. It is trained for the wrong things, but I don't want it trained for disaster relief and humanitarian aid, which serves often as an excuse to get our troops into places they otherwise couldn't get into. I want a different institution trained and given the resources to do the work around the world that we should be doing.
In the middle, and then over here.
I think a pretty good follow-on to what you just were talking about. We were talking recently about conversion and how some years ago, our military started converting bases to other uses, and they started decommissioning bases and other things like that. And I know I've heard since I've been in D.C. the last few days, there's an Institute of Peace that's been established. I don't know what their mission is exactly, but I guess my question is there something within the military or within the government that is looking for ways to redirect our military dollars to peacetime uses, because there's certainly a lot of need for that. We are destroying the environment with our military. It's the biggest polluter in the world. And we are destroying humanity with our military. As we've said, mostly it's civilians who are being killed, including a lot of innocent children. So we have to turn this around, and I think it's got to come from within, perhaps the military itself. There's people in the military who don't like the direction things are going. I'm hoping that's the case. If you have any comments on that, thank you.
Well, Bradley Manning is a member of our military. There are people in the military who have the right ideas in their heads. There are an increasing number of soldiers refusing illegal orders to fight. There are GI coffee shops growing up around bases that are assisting in that work. Iraq Veterans Against the War is working with active soldiers, in particular those who have PTSD, to resist being sent back into war until they have a chance to recover a little mentally from the last bout they experienced. I think we shouldn't think of the military as a uniform block in terms of its members. There is somebody in the State Department who has decided they should promote and show a film about Dan Ellsberg now. I think there are people in the government who have the right ideas and become whistleblowers and resistors, and we should reach out to them. But I don't, I don't want the military turned into a force for good. I want it dramatically reduced in existence.
And I would say that what you said about soldiers being sent back to Iraq with post-traumatic stress disorder, you're never cured of post-traumatic stress.
No.
And as a friend of mine, a Vietnam vet, says, whenever he talks now about PTSD, he takes the D off. It's just post-traumatic stress. It's part of you. It becomes who you are. So you're never cured of it. You can't be saying, I'm going to send you to a shrink, give you a pill, and send you back to battle. It doesn't work that way, but that's what we do. And that's why these guys are doing 5-6 tours. I mean, it's utter madness.
Right.
So.
And this is another area in which current wars are nothing like ancient wars and medieval wars and pre-modern wars, because of the sophistication of the training and conditioning that gets these young men and women to go doing the things that they then cannot live with having done. And we have not figured out, not that we've put everything into trying, but we have not figured out how to uncondition them afterwards. And so we have this epidemic of stress and suicide that is out of all proportion to earlier wars because of what the soldiers are trained to do.
And again, not to keep saying I disagree, but I think that's not quite true. I think that wars in the past have done the same thing to the men and women who have suffered, and we just never paid attention to it. There are 58,000 names on that wall of Vietnam vets, Vietnam soldiers who died. That many and more have committed suicide since the end of the war. It never stops.
Yes, but that is already true with Afghanistan, right? I mean, we don't have to wait decades for the suicides to outpace.
Okay.
Right? I'm not saying that post-traumatic stress is new because the name for it is new. Right. I'm not saying that this hasn't been part of war for forever. I'm saying that it is worse. That it is worse because of. I mean, many soldiers didn't used to actually take part in war. Right? The majority of U.S. troops in World War II did not actually shoot their weapons at the enemy. They did not actually, the greatest generation, most of them didn't do more than the guy who stayed home and grew tomatoes, right? Because they had not been conditioned sufficiently to brainlessly do that in that situation. It is very difficult for most people to shoot at a human being. But when you have been conditioned to do it and have done it, as now almost 100% of our troops successfully are, you come back with that stress of having done those things and having faced those people doing them to you.
I'll stop there. I can say more, but we'll have the debate another day.
I know you can. Okay.
So, sir, go ahead.
My question is, how do we enforce the rule of law? We have fantastic laws. The Constitution provides for defense. The National Guard is supposed to repel invasions. We raise armies. We do not keep standing armies. That's what the Constitution requires. We have great treaties. So how do we get this rule of law enforced where we have these great laws enforced and end all the wars?
Good question.
Well, I know the questioner, and he has as many good answers to that question as I do, and a lot of my answers are in my previous book, Daybreak. But I think that anyone who wants organizationally or individually to be part of an effort, be in the strategic planning stages at the moment, to really start working with Spaniards and reaching out to thank and encourage Spain for enforcing the laws we won't enforce ourselves, should contact me. I'm not saying give up entirely on any hope for our own government, but I think the time is right for some outreach to Spanish-speaking people in our own country and everywhere else, but in particular to the Spanish government to encourage them and to oppose the messages that are now public that they have been getting from our government, encouraging them not to enforce international laws.
Yeah, Mr. Swanson, thank you so much, A, for the book, because I think War is a Lie is, I encourage everyone who watches or listens to our show to read this book, to wrestle with it, as you would any good text, to think about what we're doing and what you're telling us that we're doing, and the analysis that you bring to this, and the passion you bring to your work, and the fact that you are one of those men who doesn't just write books, one of those people who doesn't write books, but you put your body on the line to stand up for what you believe. So thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Perfect. I appreciate it. Thank you.
So I want to thank all of you for coming out. I want to thank Busboys and Poets for doing this evening here in Washington, D.C. at 5th and K, Center for Emerging Media, the Mark Steiner Show. We thank you all for coming out tonight. And as you wrap this up, we're not wrapping up. The books are for sale outside. Go get them. Bring them back in here. David will sign them. Those of you who have the books with you now, David will sign them here.
Free Speech TV!
Thank you all so much.